Oh, wait, you're listening.
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
All right.
You're listening to Radiolab.
Radiolab.
From
WNYC.
See?
Yeah.
And NPR.
Hey, I'm Jad Abumrad.
I'm Robert Krulwich.
This is Radiolab, and
today our subject actually started in the middle of a phone conversation.
There's Krulwich.
With Lulu.
Hello.
Hi.
Lulu Miller was a producer here, then she decided to go off and become
a writer.
In Charlottesville.
But we still talk to her from time to time about stories, and in this conversation she told us this one particular tale
This one is so awesome. All right, so it's the 1970s. There's a lovely couple, very much in love, Richard and Tucker.
Two guys.
Two men. They're living in West Philly, and they've been together for over a decade. Richard's a little bit older, kind of getting into his 50s, and he starts to think, you know, what if I get sick? What if I die? You know, I really wish Tucker could be a legal member of my family. I want him to have visitation rights in the hospital or ability to make decisions or all these kinds of things that, you know, married couples have. So basically he's thinking, gosh, it's frustrating that I can't marry my partner because the law won't let me. So that's his predicament.
And she says there didn't seem to be any solution to this predicament. Richard would think about this all the time and each time come upon the same sad thought, which is that I can't marry Tucker because...
because the law won't let me.
Nothing I can do. Right?
And then one day...
it hit him.
And so his partner, Tucker, is about, I think, 5 years younger. He's a really, like, big, burly, handsome dude with a beard. And he decides one day, oh... I'm going to adopt Tucker as my son.
Wait,
so
what?
He goes and so he somehow actually does this. He successfully adopts Tucker, gets the adoption certificate, and then sends out a birth announcement, like announcing, welcome our new, my new son, Tucker, 72 inches long and 180 pounds, the birth of our baby boy. And
can you even do that?
Yeah, you can.
It just seems like you're transgressing some deep boundary there.
It does. No, it...
like that next night when you cuddle up in bed with the... you're like, this is just wrong now. This is suddenly very wrong.
I'm sure that... I mean, maybe there's that moment and it's kind of funny, but I think this story is just... there's something to it. There's moments where, like, a little specific thing solves something that doesn't seem... like there was supposed to be any solution. Like it was one of these sad things of the world you just had to accept. And then you, from time to time, hear a story where there's this solution. And suddenly it very dramatically changes the possibilities of the world we live in. Do you know what I mean?
I do, yeah.
It's a form of hope.
Lulu says she keeps a list of these stories that she plans to one day write or make for the radio. She's got dozens of them, and she thinks of them as, like...
when duct tape solves the ethereal sadness.
Stories where some small, stupid little human thing reframes the world, and suddenly the world is a little less sad, a little less lonely. We got inspired by that idea, so in this show, we're going to have three stories that are basically...
about that.
Yeah, that sort of take off from that notion. Three stories of people who make a little switch, a little flip in their reality, and suddenly it's, you know, a little bit better.
So to begin, let's start with a story which is actually is almost like it happened by accident.
It involves a rescue. A double rescue, really.
To tell it, here is our own Pat Walters.
So a few months ago, I went to St. Louis because I'd heard this story about a guy who had this pet that basically saved his life. And the pet is a bird. It's about this guy named Jim Eggers.
Oh, you're recording?
Yeah. I'm gonna record.
I wasn't including him in this.
And in 2005, Jim was living by himself in a little apartment in St. Louis.
Working in a Halloween industry.
It was the winter, so Jim had just finished up his latest season at the local haunted house.
I've done the Halloween stuff for 19 years.
What do you do?
Most of the time I've been in costumes and so forth, or wear masks.
You know, like jumping out from behind dark corners and scaring people.
I can scream and, you know, go nuts.
Which is kind of a strange gig for a guy like Jim because he has a really hot temper.
What's technically your diagnosis?
I have a bipolar disorder with psychotic tendencies. And what that pretty much is when I'm having a mood swing or whatnot, I can become extremely dangerous and violent.
While I was there, he was totally calm. But Jim tells me that once he feels a mood swing start coming on,
it feels like real strange and tingly.
Might just be a few seconds before
all of a sudden, boom, here you are like the Incredible Hulk.
Yeah. Have you ever physically attacked someone and hurt them?
Yeah.
Jim's known around his neighborhood for just losing it from time to time. He shouts at people on the street, punches dents in people's cars. One time he even poured hot coffee from a second-story window onto his neighbor's head.
I go off on people, and it's horrible.
And if you ask Jim, he'll tell you this all goes back to when he was 7.
At the age of 7, I lost my kid brother in the Mississippi River. I saw him drown, and
You saw him...
I witnessed him drowning. We wandered away from home. We were not properly supervised by my parents. And I told my brother not to go over into the river because it was deep. He didn't listen to me, and then the currents dragged him down. I saw him bob up and down 3 times, and the third time he didn't come back up. And I was pleading with God, you know, crying, please bring him back, I'm going to be in trouble.
And when Jim's parents found out, they blamed him.
You know, it was my fault my brother drowned. I should have saved him. And then other times they told me that, you know, they wish it was me that died instead of my brother.
And then when he was 16, Jim's mom threw him out of the house.
She just said one day, get out, Jim?
Yeah, she said she didn't want me over there anymore. Get out.
After that, Jim's life kind of spiraled out of control. He ended up living on the streets for years and just getting angrier and angrier at everyone around him. And then, in 2005, which is where our part of the story begins, Jim did something that got him in very serious trouble.
Tell me about the Archbishop situation.
Okay, as far as the Archbishop...
He'd been reading news reports about sexual abuse in the Catholic Church, and for reasons that aren't entirely clear, Jim had become convinced that the local Archbishop...
Archbishop Raymond Burke...
...was involved in covering this stuff up.
Bailing out priests that have sexually assaulted children and so forth... And one day...
He was watching the news, and he saw Burke on there.
Like on the 12 o'clock news.
Talking about something, can't remember what.
And at that point, I snapped and picked up a phone, dialed the Archdiocese, asked them to connect me to his office. Which, like idiots, they did. And when they did, I told them, you know, I ought to come down and kill you. I said, I may even do that Sunday.
A couple hours later, Jim went out to run some errands.
And when I head out the door, here were the police.
Jim ended up getting sentenced to a year of probation. Just a few weeks into his probation, something happened that would basically set the story that we're telling about Jim in motion.
Like a year's probation.
It was a typical Sunday morning, and Jim's at church, and he runs into this couple.
These people that own Variety Bird Shop in Valley Park. The husband stopped me and said, well, we... know where you can get an African gray parrot, and they told me that she came with a cage. I said,
Why would they approach you?
Well, I was putting $100 aside every month to pay for a baby African gray parrot.
And you have to understand that Jim is kind of an animal nut. He's had
dogs
and cats,
guinea pigs and stuff like that
his whole life.
Never a bird.
But when Jim read about these African gray parrots, he became kind of obsessed with getting one.
Because I knew they were highly intelligent, and they were a lot of fun.
So when the bird shop people came up to Jim and said, we can get you an African gray parrot.
And she comes with the cage for $550.
Jim thinks to himself, that's like half what I was going to pay. So he says,
you know, I'll go ahead and take it. Yeah. Because that was too good of a deal to pass up.
There was a catch, though. The bird wasn't at the shop. It was being sold by this local kid who was just trying to get rid of her.
I went over there, and she looked absolutely horrible because this kid didn't take care of her.
She was about a foot tall.
You want some peanut butter?
She had a black beak.
Pretty yellow eyes, too.
Piercing yellow eyes.
Bright red and tail feathers. Mm-hmm.
But when Jim first saw her,
she didn't have any flight feathers in her left wing.
Because she'd torn all of them out.
Hello. Yeah, she was plucking her feathers.
See something, huh?
Which is this awful thing birds do when they get really stressed.
And,
hey,
I mean, she looked horrible. I almost wanted to say no after I saw her.
But he knew he couldn't just leave her there. So he paid the kid.
Took her home and gave her lots of loving and care. And within like 3 days, she bowed her head. That means she pretty much bonded with me. Like the third week I owned her, I was in another room on the telephone, and she's like, "Hey, Jim, do you want a beer?" And it's like, I don't drink beer.
She would say that to you?
Yeah, she asked me if I wanted a beer, and then she'd ask, tell me stuff like, "Will you get me a beer?" You know, made me choke on my coffee.
But a few weeks later, Sadie started imitating Jim.
Yeah. She'll impersonate a little chuckle that I do. It's like, yeah. It's even better than Elmo could laugh.
And as Sadie spent more time with Jim, she learned to say words and phrases. And then one day,
Several weeks after I had her,
something kind of wonderful happened.
I came home and I was like in a really bad mood, and I knew I had to do something.
One of those moments when Jim could just feel he was about to lose control.
So I was trying to talk myself into calming down.
What would that sound like?
I was talking to myself and was telling myself, calm down, you'll be okay, everything's fine, you know, and it's not so bad.
And then
she started repeating it.
Saying, calm down, you'll be okay, everything's fine.
Exactly.
Just like Jim was saying.
Word for word.
And I was like, wow, and it's like, and that gives me an ideal.
Jim started rewarding Sadie every time she said something that might help calm him down. Like, you know.
You'll be okay.
Treat.
Everything's fine, it's not as bad as you think.
Treat.
Shut up.
Treat.
I don't want to hear it.
Treat.
I love you, Jim, and she'll make a kissing sound.
Treat, treat.
It just goes on and on and on.
So Jim went online and actually found this special kind of cage that you can carry around on your back.
Then I took her with me just everywhere.
He even got her registered as a service animal, kind of like a seeing eye dog.
I mean, everywhere.
Where would you go with her?
I've taken her into churches. I've taken her aboard the public buses. Take her to the gym, yes. I've even taken her into like a couple of casinos through here.
And Jim and Sadie had a pretty good situation. When Jim started feeling himself get mad, he'd tell himself, calm down. Sadie would repeat him. But then, one day, a few years ago, Sadie did something that went beyond mimicry. Jim says he doesn't exactly remember the first time it happened.
Oh, I can't think of anything right now because I'm like blanking out.
But it probably went something like this. Jim's just out in the neighborhood one day. He's got Sadie in her little backpack cage.
Uh-huh.
And something happens that sets Jim off. I don't know, a car cuts him off at the crosswalk. And immediately, Jim starts getting that tingly feeling.
Yeah.
And then, in this split second fraction of a moment before Jim starts to talk himself down like he does,
calm down, Jim. Calm down.
He hears, calm down, Jim. From Sadie.
Exactly.
She says it first?
Yeah.
Wow.
Like she knew what was in his mind or inside him, like before he even did anything.
Oh yeah, she knows. She can sense that.
How do you suppose that was happening? I mean, maybe she...
I don't know. I mean, Jim thinks maybe she can like feel a change in the way he's moving.
I have like body tremors when I'm starting to really get furious.
Maybe Sadie can pick up on those tremors. And Jim says this just kept happening.
She does it all the time. And, you know, it makes you stop to think. If I would go off on a person or something like that, you know, I wouldn't have any
remorse or anything. But, I mean, it's just a little innocent animal.
But seemed to know him in this really intimate way. Which kind of blew my mind.
Yeah.
But Sadie didn't do it while I was there. So I left Jim this tape recorder and I asked him to try to get something like this on tape, just so I could prove it to people.
Hello, my name is James Eggers, and I'm standing here with my parrot, Sadie. She's standing here right next to me on her little perch.
Say something. You can say something to the... You can say something to the microphone, huh?
A week or so later, I got the tape back.
What do you have to say?
And Sadie was on there saying all kinds of things, like, hello.
Hello.
She said her name. She said, good girl. Things that I could imagine Jim saying to her.
But did you ever get a sense from anything she said that there was a kind of weird intuitive exchange happening or something?
Not really. But I thought if it happens as often as Jim says it happens, that someone in his neighborhood must have seen it.
Yeah.
So I called this woman who runs a coffee shop around the corner from his house, asked her if she'd seen it. She hadn't.
Oh.
Then I figured I could call the company that runs the buses and the trains that Jim rides every day, thinking that maybe one of their drivers would have seen him get upset about something.
And?
Nothing. And then I called Jim's best friend, Larry, and I figured if anyone has seen this, it would be Larry, because he's around them, like, all the time. He hadn't either.
Huh.
So I called Jim to ask if I was, like, missing anybody. He didn't answer, so I left a message. Left another message. Then finally...
Hello?
Hi, Jim. I got him on the phone. It's Pat again.
Oh, yeah, go ahead.
It seems like nobody else has ever seen her or heard her say those kinds of things to you.
Well, she's definitely has said those, but I mean, she's not going to say the same thing every time she talks to me.
Right, but has anyone ever seen her talk you down from being mad?
No, because most of the time people aren't around me when I'm having a mood swing.
Hmm. I started to wonder, like, is this the kind of thing a parrot is even capable of? So I decided to check.
Hello.
I called the scientist.
I'm Dr. Irene Pepperberg, adjunct associate professor at Brandeis University.
She's basically the world's expert on African gray parrots. So I asked her, have you ever heard of anything like this before?
Not exactly, but it doesn't surprise me.
In fact, Irene told me that something kind of similar had happened to her once.
Yes, I mean there's
with this parrot named Alex that she worked with for like decades. Irene told me that whenever Alex would get out of line,
preening instead of working or butting in with the other birds when he should be quiet so we could train them, we'd say to him, "Calm down, just calm down." And one time I come storming into the laboratory because I've just come from a horrible faculty meeting when I was in Tucson. And Alex takes one look at me and he says, "Calm down."
Really?
Yeah. And I actually stormed off and I said something to the effect of, "Don't you tell me to calm down." And I went into my office and slammed the door.
And Irene says that a parrot, like Alex or Sadie, probably doesn't know
what calm down means, or you'll be okay, Jim. She may not know what each of those little phrases mean.
But she knows that when she says calm down, Jim calms down.
So she has learned from association that that will bring her flock mate back to normal.
Which is a big deal for parrots, Irene says, because they're prey. So they're constantly looking out for each other, trying to keep from getting eaten. And in Sadie's case,
she's in a flock of two at this point. So if she wants to feel comfortable while preening or eating, she needs to know that he's going to be watching out for her. Remember, she doesn't have a big flock. She just has him.
Wow. So in the end, what do you make of all this?
Well, I mean, I can't prove that she does the things Jim says she does. But on the other hand, everyone I talk to around Jim says that whatever is happening between them is keeping him from threatening people on the street, from punching dents in people's cars. It's just keeping him a better guy.
Yeah.
So maybe it doesn't matter.
I don't care if anybody believes me or not. You know, it's not, I'm not here to prove anything to anybody. That's not the point. The point is, I know what she does, and that is that.
No, okay, come on, girl. Say hello.
Not burp. No, don't eat. No eat.
Thanks to Pat Walters.
Come on, fly home.
Into Sadie.
Hello.
Good girl.
Into Jim.
Yep.
Sadie, what are you looking at, huh?
We'll be right back.
She's got her eyes focused on me and trying to figure out what you're doing with the mic.
Best, yeah.
Visit our website, radiolab.org. You can see pictures of Jim and Sadie, and you can subscribe to our podcast, radiolab.org.
Hi, this is James Eggers.
Hello, Lab. It's Lulu.
Radio Lab is funded in part by the Alfred P. Sloan Foundation,
enhancing public understanding of science and technology in the modern world.
More information about Sloan at www.sloan.org.
Radio Lab is produced by
WNYC and distributed by
NPR. Okay.
End of message.